Speechless is brought to you by
Canopy Strategic Partners.
The civil rights movement did not change people's hearts and minds. The civil rights legislation did not change people's hearts and minds. What changed behavior was when people's money was affected.
Welcome to part two of this Speechless episode. I'm Charles Hopper.
I'm Dr. Kathy Yoon Khalil.
I'm Lori Perkins.
And this is Speechless. We're going to pick you up exactly where we dropped you off in the last episode. Stay tuned for more.
It's interesting. It kind of, what I was thinking of when you were talking was that, you know, what we need, we hear a lot of talk about allies, you know, that we need allies in order to advance this work, but we need allies within our own communities as well, right? For that support, because this work is not easy. We don't always know the path forward. And there's this phenomenon, I think, of, I don't even know if this is the right term for it. I'm gonna call it diversity fatigue. I see happening broadly in our community, but I wonder about it even within our communities, when you've been sort of beating your head against a wall or you know, as you were saying, Jasmine, if you're sort of the only one at maybe a small institution that's trying to get some traction around something, and it can, I think, get frustrating because you can't always get those early wins that tend to sustain program development, you know? And I think the community piece maybe is a part that community within is maybe something that helps that. But what do you think about this whole the fatigue thing among our own communities as well as other communities?
Yeah, so I've heard it just called equity fatigue. And I think it's 100% real, mostly because of the emotional labor that goes into it. That's just exhausting, and in a very different way exhausting, right? So it's emotionally draining and mentally tolling and taxing, right? And if you're not finding ways to replenish and rejuvenate, it manifests itself in a variety of different ways. And we don't always think about them being physical, but they can manifest in physical ways. You know, I've had times where I'm just like, oh my gosh, I am so tired. I'm so tired. Like, my body is literally exhausted. And then when you think about it, it's like, oh, I had like a number of really hard conversations, right? And, you know, or just think about if you got in an argument or a fight with a loved one, right? And then after that fight, you're like, you're just drained, right? I think it's a very similar thing. And also one of those reasons why we have to talk about, you know, self-care and taking care of each other and taking care of our community, because I think it's real in a very different way and we don't even always know it or even recognize it, right? And I think that is part of the thing that our community and industry has to work on, is being more aware, right? And we get used to certain people being the one to bring it up all the time, or certain people being the one to say something, but we don't take the time to think about, oh, maybe I should be the one to say something this time and allow that person to have some rest, and to not be the one that's expected to say it, right? And I think that's one thing that, you know, allies and advocates and co-conspirators can think about, is like, let's distribute the labor, right? So that it's not falling just on one person. And then they're the ones that's having to take that toll, you know, not to digress the conversation, you know, where you have places where folks are trying to start something new, like a union, right? Not to say we need to go off on a conversation on unions, but a lot of times the folks who started that movement, they don't make it to the end. They end up leaving before things get finalized, right? Because it's just emotionally taxing and exhausting, right? And so I think that's one piece that we probably don't talk about enough. I also don't think we talk about compensation for emotional labor enough, but that also is very much a digression. but I do think it's a topic worthwhile maybe for another time, especially for those folks, like Kiara said, don't have equity or diversity in their title, but yet are doing the work constantly and taking on so much extra emotional labor that they're not being compensated for. I think that's a big blind spot in our industry that is very connected to that fatigue.
I think that brings up an interesting question of whose job is it to bring up this work or champion this work at an institution, right? Like, if you're sitting there listening to this podcast being like, is it me? Should it be me? What other questions should you be asking yourself? Like, what is the responsible way to go about kind of championing or facilitating or promoting this work at your institution?
There's so much to be said in this area. Okay, so I'll start with the fatigue part. I think that there are two different kinds of fatigue associated with this. There's the fatigue of the folks that are doing the work and that are burning out because not enough of the other folks in the institution, organization, whatever it is, are sharing that burden, and that there isn't a lot of recognition or empathy for the fact that the work doesn't stop for us. We don't stop being people of color once we walk out of our institutions. We still have to carry that emotional, mental, physical labor of being people of color in hostile environments sometimes. So there's just this kind of continued fatigue, right, that when it's added to the place of work where you're at for 40 plus hours, that can be really, really, really overwhelming, exhausting, and have adverse consequences for your physical, mental, and emotional health. And so the focus and the highlighting of resources related to health and well-being for BIPOC communities that has really come up out of the pandemic are real, and people should really tap into those and really take the time for themselves, right? We really can't help others when we are not healthy ourselves. And so just that reminder of self-care is step number one. The other kind of fatigue is, it goes along with white fragility. There is a real emphasis, right, in a post-George Floyd, post-pandemic, I think we're still in a pandemic, I'm just going to say we're still in a pandemic, where folks just want to get back to what they consider to be normal, right? What they consider to be life before we had to talk about race, before we had to talk about diversity, before we had to talk about equity and inclusion, and EDI has to be a part of every meeting and every conversation, right? They did not have to think about this for the majority of their life, the majority of their career, and there was no accountability around that. And so now that those things are being infused, there is a real fatigue around, like, I just want to do my work and I don't want to have to have inclusive pedagogy on, right? Like, I don't want to have to think about those things. I just want to get back to quote unquote normal. So there is this other type of fatigue that creates resistance in spaces where the folks who are trying to do the work, the other folks are saying, yeah, I hear you. Why are we still talking about this? I want to do just this. How do I just get this done? And so that's where we start to find the boilerplates, right? How do I just have a plug and play to say, I'm doing this to check this box and I can keep moving, right? That's where the tokenism comes up. That's where some of the other things that are problematic, where there's kind of a little bit of, I don't want to say stagnation in the movement, but there's a little bit of stagnation, right? Because the people who've been doing the work are tired, and the resistance to the work has built up to a point where it's keeping things from moving forward. And so we're kind of at this standstill. And there's just frustration. How do we overcome that? It depends on the organization. It depends on the people. How do we reinfuse energy into movements, right? That's people who study movements talk about those different things all the time. This is where I say, let's go back to the professionals, the social scientists, the folks who really study this and have identified best practices, and really listen to them. What have we learned from historical movements about what has worked? I say time and time again that the civil rights movement did not change people's hearts and minds. The civil rights legislation did not change people's hearts and minds. What changed behavior was when people's money was affected. You could get sued and your business could get shut down if you didn't let Black people sit at your counter or walk into your store, right? There was some kind of counter adverse effect or consequence that prompted you to change that behavior. Were you nice to those people, to the Black people that were in your store? No. There had to be a slow evolution, right, to where the change happened in incremental ways, right? So just recognizing that even where we are in this post George Floyd highlighting diversity, people's hearts and minds haven't changed about police brutality against Black people. People's hearts and minds haven't changed about the Black infant mortality, right? Or just how Black women are, you know, at risk of dying, or women in general, the most dangerous point in their life is when they're pregnant, right? Like, those things that we've started to talk about just a little bit over time, right? Because of this tragic period that we've been in, people's hearts and minds about those topics really haven't changed, where we've changed behaviors, right? And so it just having that recognition of the fatigue, what is it going to take to actually change a behavior within my organization? And when I say a behavior, that's where we're talking about changing policies and practices and how institutions operate. What is it going to take to get there? And recognizing that there's no magic wand. It does take time, as frustrating as it is, right? And when talking with students, particularly undergrads, they want it to happen right now. They don't understand why we can't just get rid of this problematic professor or eliminate this horrible course or do XYZ, right? Recognizing that change can happen in different ways. And that's, again, if we put like the creativity back into how we have these conversations, I really think we haven't even begun to tap into the possibilities and the opportunities, because we don't have everybody at the table talking about it.
It's so interesting because I'm thinking, you know, and similarly, but also in a different context, you know, as conservation orgs, we're always talking about behavior change, right? Like, we're always talking about how do people, you know, what ways do we inspire folks to act to change their behavior for wildlife conservation and for the environment and ocean conservation, right? And, you know, we talk about that all the time and recognize it just because, you know, I tell somebody to use this reusable water bottle doesn't mean that they're actually going to do it, and or maybe they use it for a time, maybe they'll use a free one that I give them, right? And so that idea though of like transferring some of these same concepts to things that we talk about on a regular basis is very fascinating to me. I do also think that that does point out the whole, like, it's about policies, right? And it's about your practices, and it's not necessarily recognizing that you're not going to just change the culture immediately, right? But you put a policy in place and someone is going to lose their job if they don't follow it. Well, they're going to do it, right? Or they're going to leave the organization. And honestly, I think that's okay, right? Let folks leave. If this is not the culture that they want to be a part of, they will find somewhere else and they'll land on their feet, right? And that is okay. I think we get really wrapped up in loyalty at our organizations, and we get wrapped up in particular people and maybe not the best interests of the organization 10 years from now, right? We're thinking about right now and how we need to make adjustments for this one person, rather than being like, let's make some adjustments and that person can make a decision themselves to leave. And, you know, we move at the slowest, we move at the pace of the slowest person in the room. And that is a problem. And I think policies and procedures is the way that maybe we go about doing those changes. And it also means that you've got to have your leadership on board, right? And your leadership has to be the one that's making those kind of blanket decisions to say, yes, this is our new policy, posting all salary description on all jobs and done. Like, that's just what we're doing, right? And we don't necessarily always have leadership willing and ready to make those bold choices, right? It makes me think of, so there is a report that came out, it's connected to the book, the author of the book, The Sum of Us by Heather McGee, and the organization that she ran, I think, I can't remember if she still runs it, but it's the Demos organization. They like assessed and tracked and reported their entire process around what transformation of their org would look like, specifically around racial equity. And it lays out the amount of work that actually goes into making transformation. And it wasn't necessarily about the culture. It was really about how they worked on those policies and procedures. And the executive director was the one that had to say, we are doing this. And then their VP spent 75% of their time for 3 years to make it happen, right? And like, I think when folks were like, when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, they had to like invest so much in so many resources. And then we get all excited and we're like, oh, I got a couple hours. You know, I got everybody to meet once a month, and then people get upset when like nothing happens. So it's like, I think that we don't always realize how much needs to go into that. And we haven't really seen folks who have really done it. So that whole piece around, let's look to the professionals, right? The people and the movements and the history, like, I don't think we do a very good job of that, because there are examples that we can look to. And I don't think that we currently are doing it. I think it's very enlightening for folks who are just thinking about this journey. And as you're trying to think strategically, like, it gives an example of the amount of work that needs to go into it.
I love that this idea of that, you know, that we move at the pace of the slowest person in the room. And I am the kind of, I don't want to leave anybody behind. I understand and I absolutely agree with the idea of if you're not on board, you're not on board, and we're going to keep moving ahead. But Charles gave me a wonderful analogy of a way of looking at it that I have used in other conversations since then. And it works for what you're saying about, you know, hey, get on board, where this train is leaving, and my desire to have everybody on the train. I don't want them to be left behind. And his analogy was that of kind of an infinite train. And this train is moving. We're not stopping the train and waiting for you all to get on here. This train is moving ahead, but it continues, and you can get on at any point while we're still going way over here. You can still hop on that train. And that is I like that. I'm just a huggy, touchy feely. Oh, I'm not literally huggy because I don't. Yeah, but I like the idea of embracing everyone. I want everybody to get on board. And that is one of my struggles with this whole issue of fatigue. Is you know, I get it. I get it. This is, you know, it's like, you're tired. Think how tired we are, right? You know, And so I understand that, but I want that train to keep moving, and I want to welcome all people on board of it, you know. So
I think you touched on something interesting there, Lori, that a lot of the not all, obviously, but a lot of the folks who do this work, you know, come from or are in professions where people pleasing is the way that they measure their self-worth, how much people like them is how they, yep, exactly. Lori's pointing at herself and nodding vigorously while I'm saying this. And so it is, we are no stranger to the idea that we have been long conditioned, especially as female identifying individuals, to make people happy, care for people, you know, make sure nobody feels uncomfortable or left behind in any of this work. And it's okay to say, it's okay for people to feel a bit uncomfortable. And it's okay to say that just because someone isn't coming along to the next stop on the train tracks, that doesn't mean we're leaving them behind per se. It just means that they're on a different route.
Yeah, I'll just say, as the attorney who is perhaps a little bit more comfortable with making other people feel uncomfortable, because that's what I was trained to do, right? It's an adversarial profession by default. And I would say I'm not, you know, a lawyer in a courtroom, specifically because I don't believe in arguing just for the sake of arguing. That's not something that I enjoy, but I do like the idea of helping other people to see multiple points of view, right? And I think that that's one function that happens in the courtroom, is that multiple sides of the same situation are presented. But I do think, you know, one of the things that you've touched on is who gets to feel uncomfortable. And for a long time, it has been the underserved, underrepresented, under-resourced, under-supported individuals, groups, communities that are consistently made to feel uncomfortable and sit with a discomfort. And the minute that there's any shift, right, to have that discomfort shared by others, we find ourselves in places where we're talking about white fragility, white tears, just things that some folks are afraid to even just say out loud, right? And then we also find ourselves in a space sometimes where different communities are saying, well, what about us? So there's also times where different BIPOC communities feel at odds with each other because they feel like there's an attention being focused on one group as opposed to, oh, well, we are the most, you know, underrepresented, or we are the most invisible, or we are the most, right? And so this idea that there can be solidarity and community that is used to build bridges while meeting people where they are, and recognizing that while we all might have needs, we may all have slightly different needs. So while yours might be this, this group might need X, and that we can work on achieving those things by working together. But I think that there, it's that together piece, right? That it's a and, not an or. And so having those conversations of how can we help X and help Y? How can we achieve X, right? Which is our mission of our organization, and right, do it in this way that fulfills our EDI goals. And so really being able to have those conversations that talk about the and, that talk about pulling people in as opposed to pushing, calling them out. I've really been struggling with like how to adjust that of calling people in versus calling people out, because I'm okay with doing both. And sometimes I do feel like a call out is needed when something egregious has happened, but I also recognize that that call out does not set me up for that next interaction with that person for me to then be able to call them in, right? So really trying to understand, you know, and using that analogy with Charles and Lori have set up is, okay, if I'm calling someone in and they miss the opportunity to hop on the train at this stop, how can I engage with them in a way to where they're prepared to hop on the train at a future stop, right? How can I continue to set that person up and help move that person along while meeting them where they are? So, you know, tailoring those conversations and really focus on solidarity, really focus on how do we all move forward together? It can be really challenging, right? Because people are coming from places of deep hurt. And I think of like generational and ancestral hurt that we carry, right? And that we bring into these spaces. And that's when I talk about like who are we accustomed to feeling discomfort, right? And being uncomfortable. And so I really do try to practice shifting that discomfort and allowing other folks to learn, because the only way they're going to be comfortable with the discomfort is by practicing being in uncomfortable spaces, right? That's what the whole idea of cognitive behavioral therapy is, right? Is your repeated exposure to these uncomfortable situations. And so really practicing, how can we push the envelope in a way that creates just enough discomfort to push someone to a place of maybe reflection, to a place of something, right? Push something without pushing them out. It's a balance. It's a strategy. It's a technique. And that's where I say, again, work with the professionals.
Yeah. In that similar mindset, one of the things that we've been talking about too is sometimes these conversations require that being uncomfortable, and maybe what we need is a brave space as opposed to a safe space, right? Like we constantly talk about having a safe space, but being uncomfortable inherently does not feel very safe, right? But you may need to be uncomfortable. And so maybe let's talk about having a brave space, right? So then you're also giving permission for folks to do the calling in and the calling out or pulling in and being uncomfortable and trying to get comfortable being uncomfortable, right? Because all of that is around vulnerability, right? And you there's so much courage that is required to do that. And so setting up the space where everybody has the ability to be brave, right? Because it's brave in different ways, like brave for like the BIPOC folks in the room, brave for white folks in the room, right? It's just a different kind of courage, but it's all courage, right? And so I've really been enjoying trying to set the tone of having a brave space as opposed to a safe space, because I think that ties in to exactly what you were just talking about, Kira.
Yeah, I like to ground it in our common humanity, right? Like it's something that, you know, even that term has evolved around who we, you know, include in that. But I'd like to think that where we are today, when we talk about our common humanity and that there is some degree of connectedness to each of us, right? There's something that we can relate to the other person, regardless of the generation, the age, the field, the background. There is that common, there is something about our common humanity. And so starting with that place of understanding, you know, what is important to the people in the room, right? And being able to share, right? What their values are, what they care about, and recognizing that there are going to be commonalities and that we ultimately do have more in common than differentiates us. And getting to that place with a group of truly diverse people and even racially or ethnically homogenous groups, right? There's still a lot of diversity of thought there. Even getting those folks to be on the same page about what we mean when we're talking about, you know, equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging, justice, access, all of those pieces. And also there's a piece of it where it's like, you really can't achieve progress on one of those letters without taking into account the other letters. They're intertwined and overlapping and intersectional. And so, but being able to have a constructive conversation that focuses and includes just enough, right? You're talking about equity and then you have these subheaders of these other things that help, you know, justify or help explain why equity is important or vice versa with diversity or inclusion. But just that recognition that you really need all of those pieces in order to advance any one of those efforts.
We're not done yet. We still need to debrief this episode. But there was so much rich material here, we want to give you time to check it out. Comb through this episode. Pay attention. Take care. There's much more to come.